Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Change means a tax code that doesn't reward the lobbyists who wrote it, but the American workers and small businesses who deserve it.
I fought to get million-dollar checks out of our elections. I fought lobbyists who stole from Indian tribes. I fought crooked deals in the Pentagon. I fought tobacco companies and trial lawyers, drug companies and union bosses.
Senator John McCain and Senator Barack Obama from their respective convention speeches. And with that, it's our presidential election series, 30 issues in 30 days. Issue 2, Obama, McCain, and their special interests. John McCain got famous for his campaign finance reform, Obama for his small donor fundraising on the web. But they both are jumping through loopholes in their beliefs right now to beat each other in this election. And they both have a bundle of bundlers. The Wall Street firms, the very firms now seeking a bailout, have their hooks deep into both, and we'll talk about how. So let's compare Obama's and McCain's histories with special interests, their proposals for reform, and where they stand on the bailout of the banks, and we'll debate some of these issues. Later we'll ask, instead of regulating the candidates, what if the campaign rules were placed on TV? With me first, Massey Rich, Communications Director for the Center for Responsive Politics and OpenSecrets.org, and NPR Power, Money, and Influence correspondent Peter Overby. Welcome back, both of you, to WNYC. Good morning.
Hi, Brian.
Hey, Brian. How are you?
I'm okay. And Peter, that's your actual title, isn't it? You're the Power, Money, and Influence reporter for NPR?
Yeah, and the trick is to say it with a straight face.
Yeah, well, that's a great job, though. Massey, let's begin right with the current news. You have a piece on Open Secrets called Bundlers from McCain, Bundlers from McCain, Obama are among Wall Street's tumblers. So who are these tumblers and bundlers, and what are they giving?
Brian, it's a who's who of Wall Street when you look at the people who are responsible for bringing in the big money to these campaigns. Bundlers, of course, are those wealthy individuals who hit up their friends, their coworkers, their families to raise hundreds of thousands of dollars. This is beyond what they actually give from their own pockets. And when you look at both candidates, you see their roster of bundlers stocked with people who work for the firms that are getting bailed out or may get bailed out or, you know, who knows what's going to happen to them. We're talking about the securities and investment industry, real estate, insurance. For John McCain, his bundler list has at least 69 individuals who have raised at least $11.4 million for his campaign from Wall Street. They're his top source of bundlers. And after that, that's the real estate industry, which is also going to be in need of some assistance, it would appear. 55 people giving almost $10 million. And then on Obama's side, he's got similar influence from Wall Street types. He's got Wall Street as his second largest source of bundlers, at least 56 people giving about $9 million for his campaign. And then when you drill down and look at where these people work, the CEO of Merrill Lynch, John Thain, is listed as raising at least $500,000 for John McCain. That makes Merrill Lynch also John McCain's biggest donor based on employees' gifts. Not surprising when the boss at the top is supporting the candidate. People below him tend to fall in line. But you also have bundlers from Bear Stearns, or the firm formerly known as Morgan Stanley, J.P. Morgan, Credit Suisse, Wachovia. Phil Graham, the UBS vice chairman, is a bundler for McCain and was advising him at one point. A board member for Freddie Mac is on his list, and Obama's got them too. Lehman Brothers, Credit Suisse, Goldman Sachs is his number one donor. As these candidates are out there on the stump talking really tough about what they're going to do to Wall Street and how they're going to clean it up and what regulations they're going to add, you do wonder how willing they're going to be to turn around and say to these people who've bankrolled their campaigns, I don't like the way you've been doing business, and I'm going to clamp down on you.
Listeners, we want your comments and questions on our 30 issues in 30 days. Topic number 2 today, Obama, McCain, and their special interests. We'll also get into campaign finance rules and what they should be. 527s, as they're called, in some of the ads that are ramping up now in unofficial support of these candidates. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post your comments to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show for Massey Rich and Peter Overby. Maybe we should mention that bundling, a term that we've already used about 25 times and haven't really defined, is putting together many smaller contributions for a candidate, because each individual is only allowed to contribute $2,300 to a presidential candidate. But as you've heard from Massey in the last few minutes, bundling can result in millions of dollars coming ultimately from the same source. So that's kind of a loophole in the campaign finance laws. Peter, same question. In general, how do you view the relationship between these sectors and the presidential candidates? Certainly Massey made it sound like what we call the fire sector of the economy, finance, insurance, and real estate, is the number one financier of both the Obama and McCain campaigns.
Well, fire always stands pretty high in the ranks in presidential fundraising. And you have the tension that is always there in a presidential in any campaign, especially with Democrats, where you got to go where the money is to finance your campaign, and then you have to figure out how you finesse that to go to the voters with a message that the voters want. So both candidates, because they're hitting so hard on the reform issue, both candidates are having that kind of problem this year more than you've seen in some other cycles.
Do you see, either of you, these relationships affecting the content of the debate right now over a bailout? Because one of the problems that some people are having with this whole discussion in the country this week is, wait, these are the same people who got us into this mess who are now being granted almost a blank check and a blank check of authority to get us out. Is this government of this sector, for this sector, and by this sector? Is it possible, Peter Overby, to unbundle that and actually draw the relationships between campaign giving and lobbying and policy?
Well, I think we're seeing that play out right now. The easiest way to look at it, I think, is the question of CEO compensation, golden parachutes. And both the candidates have come out pretty clearly now saying that the CEOs should not expect the same kind of salaries that they did a month ago. But, you know, whether you're talking about people that the candidates probably know personally, you know, and have hung out with, because those are the kind of people that you hang out with when you're raising that kind of money and, you know, when you're working at that level of government. So it gets to be kind of a personal thing. And you have that tension again where they are going to have to back away from that and look at it more coldly. Right now, I think that Obama and McCain are benefiting from the fact that it is such an important issue in Washington that what they say is less important today than what goes on Capitol Hill.
Phil in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hello, Phil.
Yes. Listen, it's bad for both candidates. They're taking money from people they have to regulate later on, but I think by far the greater hypocrisy is Barack Obama's, who originally pledged to take public financing and now is raising extra millions and millions of dollars from the fat cats. And also, you know, he talks a good game about all of his small donors and uses it as an excuse to not take public financing. But in fact, you know, he's taken money from the fat cats just like every other politician ever. McCain has been in Congress and in the Senate for many years. He has established relationships, you know, working relationships with people from many different industries. Barack is fresh and new. I think the expectations for what their money is going to do would be much greater with the untested, new candidate than with the established maverick who probably could stand up to the money better than Barack could ever.
Phil, thank you for your call and your views. And Massey Rich, you know, it's an interesting question, at least with respect to how does, let's say, the FIRE sector of the economy and their donors compare in influence or money raised to the famous small donors who Obama has cultivated through the primary and general election season. That gets a lot of press, and it probably is a record in terms of percentage of money raised. But what is it actually compared to the big influence, big industry donors from finance, insurance, real estate, and the other really big one for Obama, which is trial lawyers?
We've got you using the lingo, Brian, the FIRE sector.
I'm impressed.
Well, the money that we measure from the finance, insurance, and real estate sector is about $25 million out of $450 million that Obama has raised. So it's significant. It's his biggest sector. But, you know, the bulk of his donors are giving in small amounts. Now, they amount to about half of his money. People who've given him $200 or less have provided about half of his cash, and those who've given more than $200 have provided the other half. When we look at Obama compared to McCain on the size of his contributions, we find that Obama is far more reliant on those smaller contributions than McCain is, and not only in the number of people, but in the amount that they provide as a percentage of his campaign, as I said, about half. And then if we look at the top tier, those who are giving more than $2,300, the maximum you could give to a single election, Obama gets about 29% of his money from those people, but John McCain gets 54% of his money from people giving $2,300 or more. So on that measure, McCain is more reliant on the bigger donors. Now, Phil raised the point about Obama's broken pledge on public financing. It certainly was a change of position. I think it reflected a change of fortunes. I don't think he ever expected he would be able to raise as much money as he did. And in some ways, we're seeing now, though, that his justification has some merit to it. He said at the time, you know, we're going to be up against a Republican fundraising machine that is going to be raising far more money than John McCain will get from the federal government, and we need to be ready. Well, that's what's happening right now, and John McCain is helping the Republican Party do that. He may not be able to collect private money for his own campaign because he's taking that $84 million taxpayer subsidy, but he's appearing and headlining, along with his running mate Sarah Palin, at Republican fundraising events where they're collecting amounts in the five figures to support the party, state parties, and efforts to get the McCain-Palin ticket elected. The Democrats are doing that, too, and Obama's similarly complicit and cooperative in that arrangement. But this is something we're seeing that's kind of new in this election, the candidate and the party really working together to raise money, even if the candidate himself can't use that money for his own campaign.
Here on the other side is McCain speaking on Friday about the money that he says Obama has gotten specifically from Fannie and Freddie employees.
We've heard a lot of words from Senator Obama over the course of this campaign, but maybe just this once, he could spare us the lectures and admit to his own poor judgment in contributing to these problems. The crisis on Wall Street, my friends, started in the Washington culture of lobbying and influence peddling, and he was right square in the middle of it.
Peter Overby, can you fact check that?
Yeah, I did fact check it, and he's right on the numbers that Obama has gotten a lot more from Fannie and Freddie than he has. In the grand scheme of the campaign financing scene right now, they are tiny numbers. I don't have them right in front of me, but we're talking about the hundreds of thousands. We're not talking about the millions.
Yeah, we've got this up on, if I could, on Open Secrets. Yeah. And it's $126,000 to Obama versus 20-some thousand to McCain. Tiny percentage.
Yeah, so he's right about that. Obama comes back, basically, and says, yeah, but all the lobbyists for Fannie and Freddie work for McCain. And he's essentially right about that. So they're both wrong.
The NewsHour on PBS fact-checked that claim, and they came up with this, that McCain did not mention that his presidential campaign has received $169,000 from directors, officers, and lobbyists of Fannie and Freddie. they say, more than 10 times what Obama has received to them, citing Federal Election Commission statistics.
There are all sorts of different ways you can slice this, Brian. And our, on our site, we have looked at contributions from employees and executives of Fannie and Freddie and their political action committees, and came up with Obama being the number two recipient over time. More money than McCain. But then, as you say, if you look at members of their boards who might also, who probably work at other companies and might sit on multiple boards, but if you want to include them, fine. And the lobbyists who also might have multiple clients, you can throw them in too. Then the numbers flip to the other side. So everyone's using, each candidate is using the numbers that seem to suit their argument.
This is WNYC.
And again,
go ahead, Peter.
I was just going to say, and again, it's a very small amount of money in the grand scheme of things.
That's right.
93.9 and AMA 20 WNYC. I'm Brian Lehrer with part two of our series for the presidential election, 30 issues in 30 days. Today, Obama's and McCain's special interests. And this is part of the whole first week that we're doing. The first five of our 30 issues are really on the state of our democracy. And today on the state of the role of money and how resilient our democracy is to absorbing a lot of money, a lot of corporate money, a lot of other money that comes in to the coffers of candidates for president and other things. And my guests are Massey Rich from the Center for Responsive Politics and OpenSecrets.org, their website, and Peter Overby, who is the Power, Money, and Influence Correspondent. Yes, that's really his title for NPR. I want to play a spot that's running right now that was paid for by MoveOn.org. And this is going to raise the whole issue of 527s, as they're known in this campaign, and a whole other channel of special interest money that does not go directly through the campaigns. This is a MoveOn spot against McCain that also happens to be on the issue of lobbyists. And you will hear from the ID at the end that this is sponsored by something called a MoveOn.org PAC.
When John McCain says,
"My friends,
my friends,
my friends,
my friends,"
you know who he's talking about? The 177 lobbyists who have ties to his campaign. More than a dozen lobbied for oil companies. McCain got $2 million from energy companies, and he didn't support the measures we need to get cleaner, cheaper fuel. So when it comes to gas prices, John McCain won't be taking care of you. He'll be taking care of
my friends,
my friends,
my friends,
my friends.
MoveOn.org political action is responsible for the content of this advertising.
All right. So, Peter Overby, let me turn to you for this, because what John McCain and probably Barack Obama, you tell me, and others say is the biggest problem in campaign finance right now is these independent groups, the Swift Boat Group from 2004, the most famous example. And they say they're a problem. Obama has asked groups like MoveOn.org not to do 527 campaign commercials on his behalf. And I gather they agreed, but they still put something out attacking McCain under another name, 527 PAC, I mean, MoveOn.org PAC. Is there really a difference?
Oh, there are so many ways to slice this. It gets really kind of insane. When you talk about 527s, you're talking about groups that are organized under a specific section of the tax code. And most of the groups that are active this year are not 527s.
That's where the number, the name comes from, right? It's a section,
yeah,
527.
Exactly. And a political action committee, in the world of campaign finance reform, a political action committee is a little bit cleaner because it's small contributions and they are disclosed. A 527 is unregulated contributions and they are disclosed. A lot of the groups are 501c4 and 501c3 tax-exempt groups, and their contributions are unlimited and are not disclosed. We actually have a whole website on this. We've been putting a lot of effort into tracking these groups this year. If I can make a quick plug, It's npr.org/secret-money. And you can go there. We have a blog where we put up as many of these ads as we can find, and we find a lot of them. And we try to explain who's behind them. There's an outfit called the American Issues Project that is supporting McCain. They are financed by at least so far, mainly by a Texas millionaire who was also a donor to Swift Boat veterans. There's an outfit called Brave New Films that is it was put together by a former Hollywood director that is doing a lot of pro-Obama stuff. And then when I say supporting McCain and pro-Obama, what I'm really saying is that they are attacking the other guy. There are very few positive ads when you get into these what these independent groups are doing.
Massey Rich, I've read that groups like this are actually on legally shakier ground this year than they were in 2004. Is that correct?
They are. The groups that you alluded to and even mentioned, the Swift Boats in 2004, were eventually found by the Federal Election Commission to have violated the law. Because they were so explicit in, as Peter points out, mostly opposing candidates, they really should have registered as political action committees, and meaning they would only be able to take limited contributions and they'd have to disclose their donors and their finances to the FEC. MoveOn.org is now almost entirely, as far as I know, a political action committee, and they raise their money and spend it through these limited means. But there are other 527s out there. So the groups that are looking to be active in 2008 are really doing so with some trepidation because of the FEC's fines against the groups that were active in 2004. Now, the FEC didn't make its decision until more than 2 years after the election was already over. And the fines themselves amounted to about 1% of the total receipts of some of these groups. So it's possible that these groups will proceed, just factoring in the cost of doing business being an FEC fine. But our Federal Election Commission was largely inactive for the first 6 months of this year because they didn't have a quorum to regulate elections and referee them. And so they never got around to exactly spelling out what's okay and what's not as it relates to 527s and sorted out some court decisions around these issues too.
So let me ask both. I want to read two comments from our comments board that contrast with each other and get your reactions before you go and we bring on some other guests. Darren from Lefferts Gardens writes, "It's amazing that people rarely consider the depth of obligation which these kinds of relationships demand. It's pretty hard for most of us to grasp how an $11 million, quote, gift creates that familiar sense of owing someone in return. The amazing thing is that we continue to hope that the differences between these two men will overwhelm the incredible ground they share on the unfettered market." But then Nancy from Little Silver writes, "I'm tired of this idea that contributions from a sector create some sort of indebtedness. My husband works for a financial company, and we have the resources to make a substantial contribution to Obama. We support Obama. We aren't buying influence for the financial sector. What are we supposed to do, not give money because our money comes from the financial industry?" Massey Rich, what do you say to either of those folks?
Well, I think Nancy has a good point, and in a presidential race, I think most of the contributions are ideologically driven, but people do have to provide to the Federal Election Commission where they work, and we're aggregating this. But I don't think that we can say that everyone in the financial sector is giving just out of the goodness of their hearts or because they like the health care plan of the candidate or his position on the war. When we see these bundles, these massive bundles of money coming in from Wall Street firms, law firms, lobbyists, to the candidates. And then we see over history that the people who raise the money and who give the money tend to do quite well if their candidate wins. They are appointed ambassadors around the world. They're appointed to regulatory positions, often overseeing the industries where they worked. There is a long track record of those who fund and bankroll these candidates getting something in return. And Dan, I think, makes a point that both parties are similarly, if not equally, obligated. The makeup might be a little different. More entertainment money to Democrats, more labor unions, more oil, gas, and energy, and agriculture and transportation money to Republicans. There are differences, but for the most part, they all have to raise big amounts of money. The only way to get elected to federal office is if you are personally wealthy yourself, or you know a lot of wealthy people.
Peter, a last thought on the state of our democracy, and Massey, I'm going to ask you too before we bring on some other guests and debate some of these issues, because that's what we're doing this week before we dive into other campaign-related disagreements between McCain and Obama. Is the state of our democracy being perverted, corrupted, in your own opinion? Is it a sham democracy? Because looking at our comments board and our phones, there is a lot of cynicism out there because of campaign finance as to whether our democracy is even real.
It seems to me that it is that things are coming to a head, basically, that there are, you know, you look at what's going on Wall Street, and it just puts such a hot light on the relationship between money and politics, and we're only just seeing the beginning of that. So I don't know if it's better. Historically, there's always been a lot of money, and so I don't know if what we're seeing now is going to crystallize that, and we're going to come out of it with something quite different from what we see now.
Massey Rich?
Well, as one of your commenters pointed out, on one level, this money is coming from individual Americans who are in some way exercising their free speech right and their right to support the candidate of their choosing. On the flip side of that, and in a way that it distorts democracy and I think distorts lawmakers' thinking on issues, this money comes from a tiny fraction of Americans. We're talking about at most maybe 3 to 4% of Americans making any contribution. So we're not talking about a vast democratic movement through our pocketbooks to support or oppose candidates. And on some level, on that level, that is where we start to see those with the money getting the access and having the influence in out of proportion to the voters.
Massey Rich from the Center for Responsive Politics and OpenSecrets.org. Peter Overby, the power, money, and influence correspondent for National Public Radio. Thank you both very much for coming on with us.
Thank you, Brian.
And we continue in a minute with this issue, too. In 30 Issues in 30 Days, our presidential election series, Obama, McCain, and their special interests. We will get two different views on what should be done to regulate money in politics and where McCain and Obama line up with those positions. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with our presidential election series, 30 Issues in 30 Days, every day at this time for the next, 29 days, as this is issue two, Obama, McCain, and their special interests. And I want to tell you that as part of our 30 Issues in 30 Days election series, we have a 30 Issues Wiki. It's not just a comments page. It's a way for you to collaborate with each other to help produce six of our 30 Issues programs. Check out the 30 Issues Wiki at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. This week's Wiki, to contribute to Friday's program, is on the topic of media and internet regulation, something many of you know about and care about. So contribute to it at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. It ought to be interesting. It ought to be fun. And it's a way of opening up this process to many of you as we continue to try to be part of the democracy, even as we're covering the democracy. So we have a 30 Issues Wiki this year at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show and contribute to start off to this Friday segment. Help us prepare the segment. Help us know what to do. This is not to comment after a segment. This is to help us know what we should be asking and talking about as you see it. The topic of media and internet regulation is our wiki topic for this week, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Before we bring in our next guest, after that whole conversation that we just had with Massey Rich and Peter Overby, I want to hear from Annette in Queens, who called in to talk about her own small contribution to one of the campaigns. Annette, are you there?
Oh, yes. Good morning, Brian.
Hi.
My husband and I, we're on a fixed income, but we faithfully send money to the Obama's campaign every month, sometimes 20, sometimes 25, sometimes 15. And I also have a son who lives in North Carolina, and he also sends in small donations, and he's volunteering. And also when I go out each day, I carry voter registration cards, you know, in my handbag, and I'm able to speak to a lot of young people who haven't signed out. What Obama has inspired is his philosophy of change comes from the bottom up, and I think there are a lot of people who are, you'd be very surprised, who are, you know, what we call this ordinary working class people who are working very hard.
So with respect to the numbers that we heard in the last segment, do you feel like your small contribution is going to get overwhelmed by people from Wall Street and things like that? And do you feel that you're going to be able to have a voice with Obama if he is elected?
Yes, I do, because right now we can't expect him to be anything but what he's doing now in order to. It's probably some of the views that he's expressing now are really not what he feels, but he knows how you have to play the game, and that's what it is about in order to get there. You can't make change until you're in the seat, and you may have to do a few things that you said you wouldn't do, but you know, if your objective is to get a chance to make the change, you can't make change unless you're in the job.
All right. And Ed, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much for your call. And we've heard what McCain and Obama are doing with respect to campaign finance, lobbyists, special interests. Now, two views of what should be done. The first comes from Bradley Smith, former Federal Election Commission chairman, now with the Center for Competitive Politics, which pretty much wants to deregulate the game. Mr. Smith, thanks so much for coming on WNYC with us. Hello.
Thanks, Brian. It's a pleasure.
What do you think McCain-Feingold has wrought?
Well, I think McCain-Feingold has been almost by any measure a failure. Just if we think about, not, you know, that the law changed how people fund campaigns, but asked ourselves, has it made our politics better? Do we get less negativity? Do we get more reasoned conversation? Does it seem to have decreased the influence of big money and lobbyists and special interest? And I think the answer to all of those things is a fairly easy, resounding no. I don't know anybody who sits around and says now, you know, thank goodness we passed McCain-Feingold. What we need to remember is that we are in a period now, and even prior to McCain-Feingold this was true, where we are regulating political speech more than at any time in our nation's history. And I don't think we're getting much return for that regulation. And I think we need to think more and more that while it may not be perfect, while it may allow things to go on that we kind of feel uncomfortable with, the idea of the First Amendment, of saying people have basically an unfettered right to engage in political speech, is probably the best system of regulation, if you will.
Which would be basically no regulation on campaign donations, which I guess you feel equal speech, to the presidential or other candidates?
I don't feel campaign regulation or campaign donations equal speech. I mean, they do equal speech. And if you don't believe that, let's say that we cut down the budget of your radio station, of this radio station, to $100,000 a year. We'd be off the air right now. We would not be talking. And that's true if we cut the budget of the New York Times or anybody else. In other words, if you limit money specifically because it's used to speak about politics, you're limiting political speech. And that's the danger in campaign finance regulation. Now, we could go all the way. We used to fund our campaigns. We elected Abraham Lincoln and Teddy Roosevelt and so on in a system in which there were really no regulations at all. We elected Franklin Roosevelt and, you know, Dwight Eisenhower and Harry Truman in a time in which there were very, very few regulations that were not easily avoided. We can go back to that period, but if people aren't comfortable with that, we can also move much more gradually. For example, if we were to simply make contribution limits what they were when they were first enacted in 1974, adjusted for inflation, they would be about double what they are now. People could give about twice as much as they currently do. So, you know, we can move gradually in the direction of deregulation as well and see if the sky does fall, as people like Matthew Rich and Meredith McGeehee will tell your listeners that it will fall. But I just don't think the evidence supports that.
If we go all the way there, why wouldn't that just enable the wealthiest among us to run roughshod over the rest of us when it comes to influence over government?
Well, there's really not much evidence that that is the case. I mean, first, the wealthy are not a uniform block, and all you have to do to know that is to look at how much money is being raised by both sides in the current election. There's a lot of money out there, and it can go to a lot of different places.
But let me stop you there for a second, because if we're seeing the finance sector, to take the obvious current example of the moment, contributing so much to both campaigns, which we are, and then we see this crisis on Wall Street and the bailout for them being supported by both parties, well, that raises a question, doesn't it?
What question does it raise?
Well, it raises the question of whether those with the most to spend on campaigns, maybe splitting it up between the two parties, as you say,
okay,
but that it still gives their interests predominance, at least the access that they have to argue for their interests. And arguably the outcome right now with the $700 billion bailout bill, over other people.
Well, this takes us back to thinking about how do things work. Now, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae spent at least 10 times as much money on lobbying, which is a constitutionally protected activity, as they spent on all campaign contributions combined, including soft money contributions back in the days when soft money was legal. This is where large businesses tend to get their influence. It's because they lobby.
Well, that's part of the discussion. So talk about lobbying.
So what are you going to do? Are you going to say people can't lobby? You can't say that. It is in our Constitution. We have a right to do that.
Right.
Now, at the end of the last segment, you asked the question, what kind of democracy do we have?
And I was going to ask you, too. You can answer that now if you want.
Well, and here's the real question. What kind of democracy do we have when you can't spend your own money to support the political candidate of your choice? What kind of democracy do we have when political candidates say, we don't want outside groups interfering in our campaigns? What the heck is an outside group? An outside group is a bunch of citizens who want to bring up issues that they don't think the politicians are bringing up. What kind of democracy is it that says those groups are bad and should be shut down? And this is what we need to, again, recognize. There's a lot of pluralism out there. There's a lot of ideas. There's a lot of things that go around. And ultimately, if you've got a government that's going to spend a couple trillion bucks a year, that's going to regulate all kinds of things. Remember, it was just a decade ago that Congress was beating up Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae and other bankers that they weren't lending enough money at subprime rates, right? Congress was beating them up over that. So they did that. Now we have a crisis. And now we're saying, well, we've got to get money out of politics. We've got to realize that when government has this kind of power, people in America are going to want to influence that government, and they're going to want to participate in that government. And you can respond to that one of two ways. You can either recognize that that's just a cost of big government, or you can decide we're going to try to extinguish political freedom in order to get these influences out of government. And we'll have some kind of wise philosopher bureaucrat who won't be influenced by politics.
But
is not an attractive vision.
Is there somewhere in between? Because there are various definitions of democracy or the ideal democracy. One might be absolute freedom, freedom of speech through money, et cetera, as I think you just laid out. Another one would be some rules to level the playing field so that, quote unquote, the little guy might have the ability to have the same influence as those corporations or labor unions or other organized wealthy or privileged individuals or groups who can overwhelm the system with money.
Well, there's two responses here. The first is the realist one that people often don't like to hear, but it's simply true. All right? An individual person, your average person, is not going to have the influence of the president of Freddie Mac in Congress. And it doesn't matter if you could abolish all lobbying, all contributions, everything. The fact is, Freddie Mac was a major economic player employing thousands of people. And if he calls and Joe Citizen calls, we know who's going to get more attention.
And look at the results of that. We're now bailing out Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae from their bad decisions.
But what I'm telling you is that has absolutely nothing to do with money, Brian. That's the way it would be regardless. As I say, if you got all money out, who's going to get the influence? We're not going to all be equal. So what we have to realize then is money is often an equalizer. In other words, somebody else comes along, a rich person, say a Ross Perot a decade ago or a George Soros more recently, and says, these are issues I want to raise. And he begins spending money, and he speaks for thousands, even millions of Americans in getting their views out there and making them heard. Now, the other element to this is simply that it is very dangerous to give government the power to determine who has spoken too much and who has not spoken enough. If you don't believe that, just think about whether you really want to give that power to pick whichever political party you don't like and pick the worst people in that party. So think about it. If you're a Republican, do you want Janet Reno as Attorney General having that power? If you're a Democrat, do you want John Ashcroft having that power? And I think the answer most people have is no. This was the fundamental insight of the drafters of our Constitution was that it's not good to give government the power to think about who they want to speak more and speak less.
Except that that's one could argue that that's why we have elections. And one of the powers of those who are elected is to make appointments. So whether that's to the Supreme Court or whether that's to some commission that's going to regulate the election laws like you used to sit on, that's another thing. And if people don't like the way they're doing it, then they can turn them out. But at least then the power rests with the ballot and not with the dollar.
Well, if you want to do away with the Bill of Rights, that's a good line of reasoning. But the reason we have a Bill of Rights is to take certain powers away from transient majorities. Again, the whole idea was we don't want to give the people who won the last election the power to start deciding who has spoken too much and who has spoken too little and who should be shut up because we've heard enough from them. That's the very danger that the First Amendment was intended to prevent. And I go back to saying, think about that. Imagine that you're out of power. Imagine the side you like is out of power and the other side has this broad discretion. For example, the New York Times the other day had an editorial in which they complained that the big problem with these groups is that some of them are telling lies and the FEC has to be on the lookout for that. And they specifically named a number of groups that happen to be on the political right. Okay, great. You know, now whether they're lying or not, I mean, those are whole other issues. But let's take the question here. Is, okay, let's suppose there are groups on the political left. Do you want George Bush and John Ashcroft and so on regulating those groups? These are the kinds of questions you have to ask yourself, and that's what the Constitution, that's what the Bill of Rights is intended to protect. We don't live in a country that's pure majoritarianism, where just because you won the last election, you can put regulators in place who are going to tell other people, you've spoken too much, you've got to be quiet now.
Last question before we bring on someone with an opposite point of view. Do you see McCain, who has been such a bête noire for groups like yours with McCain-Feingold and Obama, as being substantively different on these issues at this point?
Well, they have different emphases. What I think is ironic is that there aren't really people who are sitting around saying that they're more or less ethical because they have chosen to take or not to take government money, a government earmark, to run their campaigns rather than relying on private contributions. And this is the kind of thing. We are capable of judging the integrity of politicians, and that's what we need to be looking to do.
So you don't want to compare McCain and Obama's emphases? You can take a minute and do that.
Well, both of them have paid a lot of lip service to the idea that we need to regulate this activity. I don't know what either would do once put in office. I think it's fairly clear that if either were put in office 4 years from now, we will probably have less opportunity to influence politics. Average citizens will be further distanced from politics. Now, I want to give a real-world example to close out about how this works. The other day I learned about a case where Obama supporters have put up a can, maybe even be the campaign, although it wasn't clear to me, at a metro station in D.C. where you could contribute to the Obama campaign. And we were talking about how many federal election law rules putting out a can like that for voluntary grassroots activity violates. And this is what we're doing with this kind of regulation. We're suffocating grassroots activity. We're more regulated now than ever. And the question is, are we accomplishing anything? That's what people need to ask. And if you don't think we are, then you need to think about maybe we need to try a different approach, not keep trying more of the same.
Brad Smith, chairman of the Center for Competitive Politics and a former chairman of the Federal Election Commission. Thanks for having this conversation.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More in a minute. Issues in 30 Days, our presidential election series, Issue 2, McCain and Obama and their special interests. And we're into the part of the hour now where we are debating the issue. What should be done to regulate special interests in politics? We just heard from Brad Smith from his group. And we turn now to Meredith McGeehy, policy director at a group called the Campaign Legal Center, which does want more regulation, certainly than Bradley Smith wants. She also has a thought about another way to go about it, which is to regulate television. Meredith, welcome to WNYC. Hi there.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Let me throw some of Brad Smith's comments at you. When I asked him what he thought McCain-Feingold has wrought, he said, Do we have less special interests in politics now than we did before? Do we have a better discourse than we did before? Do we have less, you know, mean negative advertising than we did before, or less money in politics? No to all of the above. Has McCain-Feingold done anything useful in your opinion?
Oh, yes, and I think, you know, Mr. Smith kind of used a typical debater's trick, which defines the question in a way that he wants to answer it that has nothing to do with what actually McCain-Feingold sought to do. McCain-Feingold was focused on two issues. One was the role of soft money, that was corporate and union treasury funds that are flowing into elections, federal elections. And the other had to do with the sham issue ads, these campaign ads that masqueraded as issue discussion. I think if you look at both of those areas, you see that it has made a significant difference. And many people thought that if you took that money out of the system, this large money from unions and corporation treasury funds and from wealthy individuals, that the parties would die because they had become so dependent upon them. And in fact, the parties are flourishing. So in that sense, if you understand accurately what the purpose of McCain-Feingold...
But let me interrupt because our time is short and ask, to what end? If we don't have ultimately less special interest over our political system, if we don't have a higher level of discourse, if we don't have more equality in the system in terms of how it comes out in policy, has it accomplished anything meaningful at all?
Sure. What you're trying to do in any kind of campaign finance regulation is achieve a balance. Certainly, there are First Amendment rights involved, but money is not speech, in spite of what Mr. Smith and others may want to say. What you're trying to do here is find ways for citizens to engage where you don't have a system that has money having the ability to distort the process. And that's what the Supreme Court has talked about. That's the issue at play here. It's not that money is evil. Money is a tool. The question here is, can it distort the process? Are there ways for average Americans to participate meaningfully? I think with the rise of the Internet, we're seeing the ability for Americans to give more and more small money for candidates to pursue that money. That's a good thing. But this is not about, oh, is there too much money in politics? It's about saying, how do we get the candidates to be more responsive to the citizens, and how do we make big money to have less of an influence? It's not to necessarily eliminate it. And it's always going to be a struggle. There's never going to be an absolute solution, just like there's never an absolute solution to tax policy.
And you talk sometimes about, rather than going after the donations or the spending, go after television.
Well, all that's saying is that television stations that are broadcasters get their license for free, and they're supposed to be serving the public trust. And I think a lot of times, if you look at what the stations are actually putting on, particularly in election season, they don't do as good a job of that. And, of course, that's because they're allowed to define for themselves what their public trust entails.
What percentage of all these millions of dollars that are raised and spent on presidential campaigns go to television advertising? Do you know?
Well, you know, that's a hard figure to come by because it depends on how you count their buyer, how you count the focus groups, how you count the production costs, the television time. But the best educated guess in both the presidential and senatorial that I've heard has been about 60% of the money kind of goes toward either toward buying the time, running the polls for the time, doing, you know, buying these ads and running the ads. So you're really seeing in these races a large chunk of money that's going toward television. All we're saying is that if you're a broadcast licensee and you got your license for free, which is what all these broadcasters have done, they've used the government power to ensure that nobody else can use that frequency. Their payment for getting that for free is supposed to be serving the public interest. And the point.
So you're saying that should
they haven't done a good job of it.
That should be a lot of free airtime for these campaign commercials, rather than forcing the candidates to raise so much money, which makes them more indebted to special interests.
Or
that's your point.
Or they can be able to go and earn vouchers so that they have to show that they're viable candidates. They still can spend some of their own money, but you shouldn't have the determination of the race spending a whole lot of time raising money and simply transferring it to television.
And do you see Obama and McCain as being substantively different on these issues? Bradley Smith's position was, well, they may have different emphases slightly, but finally, at the end of the day, we're going to be less free with either of them, as he defines freedom.
Well, I certainly wouldn't agree about the less freedom, but I'm very pleased to see that the discussion at the presidential level is about the role of lobbyists, about the role of money in politics, and is sensitizing what Americans know in their gut, that somehow here in Washington, those people who can put up large amounts of money get a leg up. And that's because they get on the radar screen. You know, people want to say it's a dollar given and a vote bought. Mm. That's not how the system works.
But you see the two presidential candidates as relatively equivalent in this area, it sounds like.
Well, I just would say that I think they're both talking about this issue and they're both making it a key part. And I think that's really good news.
In our last minute, some people say rather than try to regulate the money, which you're almost never going to succeed at because it's always going to find the next loophole, as it did after McCain-Feingold, why not just really demand transparency, which the law does not now, so that at least if you can always trace, if journalists, if groups like yours can always trace where the money came from and then shed sunlight on it, maybe that's the best we can do and that's where we should go. 30 seconds.
It's not the best we can do. Transparency is not enough. The reality is large amounts of money have the ability to distort the political process. The courts have recognized that, and what you're trying to achieve here is a balance between the ability to do have your megaphone, but ensure the ability of citizens to make sure their voices are heard in the system.
Meredith McGeehee, Policy Director at the Campaign Legal Center, thanks a lot for coming on
with
us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's our 30 Issues in 30 Days Presidential Election Series, Part 2, Obama, McCain, and their special interests. This Friday night at 8, I'll be hosting a pre-debate special called Public Radio's Election Reset. We'll be here live on WNYC and around the country on public radio stations and XM satellite radio. That's 8 o'clock Friday night, just before the first Obama-McCain debate, which we will carry live as well. Talk to you tomorrow. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.